BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. Join me and my all-female team of detectives as we travel back in time to revisit the audacious crimes of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. Women who broke the rules, who stepped outside ordinary life to do extraordinary things. And we ask, what might their crimes and the times they lived in teach us about women's lives today? Let me take you back to 18th century Essex. Now, you won't be surprised to hear that travelling on Britain's roads at that time was a pretty perilous undertaking. There were all sorts of dangers lurking just around the bend, and it wasn't just highwaymen that you had to look out for, as this traveller near Romford discovered in 1735.
On Monday last, a wholesale butcher was robbed in a very gallant manner. He was attacked by a woman, mounted on a very good horse with a side saddle, etc. She presented a pistol at him and demanded his watch and his money.
And even if you found a cosy inn for the night, there were lady swindlers of other sorts lying in wait.
Fanny caught hold of the gentleman's arm and asked him to treat her to a glass. The gentleman was perfectly pleased with her modest demeanour and agreed to sleep with her that night. But in the morning, the moment he waked, he missed 30 guineas besides his silver. Fanny had escaped from the chamber by jumping from the window.
Today, I'm investigating the case of Fanny Davies, a common thief who led a very uncommon life. She became wildly famous in the later 18th century. People thought of her as a pickpocket, a seductress, and, according to some at least, a highwaywoman. This is a lady swindler who'll take everything you have, including your trousers. But I want to look beyond Fanny the celebrity criminal and ask, what was her life really like? Now, to help me, I'm joined by Alexandra Wilson, barrister and author of In Black and White, a young barrister's story of race and class in a broken justice system. Alexandra, welcome to Lady Swindlers.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're going to feel at home because quite a lot of our story is set in Essex today, which is your native county, right?
Absolutely. And Romford's not that far away. I was smiling as you said it.
Excellent. Now, let me ask you, Alex, why do we find some female criminals so glamorous?
I think there are still a lot of preconceptions about what a criminal looks like, and often that will be gendered. We'll often think that particularly violent criminals are often seen to be men. And so I think when we see someone who doesn't fit that stereotype, it piques our interest.
It certainly does. Now, at the age of 20, Fanny Davies commits the crime that will turn her into a legend. It's Friday, the 2nd of September, 1785. Fanny arrives at the Essex Country Inn run by Mrs. Agnes Bennett. It's called the Sign of the Three Rabbits. I love that. And it's in what's now Manor Park, about 5 miles east of central London. Fanny is dressed as a boy and she asks for a room for the night. In the bar, she falls into conversation with a prosperous grazier called Mr. John Wigglesworth. He's on his way to Smithfield Market in London to buy some young cattle. Now, Fanny pretends to be a horse dealer and they get on well together. Soon, they're sharing a pipe of tobacco. He's clearly rather taken with this young man he's just met, and he confides that he's carrying rather a lot of money on him. After supper, they retire to their respective rooms. Now, Mr. Wigglesworth is used to travelling and he knows the dangers of life on the road. So he takes precautions. He puts his money in his breeches and he tucks them under his pillow. But early in the morning, Fanny leaves her room. She creeps across the landing. She opens the door into Mr. Wigglesworth's room. And somehow, without even waking him up, she tweaks those breeches out from under the pillow. She tiptoes down the stairs and she disappears off into London. When Mr. Wigglesworth wakes up, he finds, to his horror, that his money, which was 163 guineas, a bill of exchange for £400, and banknotes totaling a massive £1,250, is missing. And of course, his breeches are gone too. I'm feeling quite sorry for Mr. Wigglesworth at this point. This is pretty humiliating. He has been tricked and robbed by a girl. Now, Alex, this is a large amount of money. That would be, at the time, maybe a year's salary for a prosperous professional gentleman. It's a pretty audacious theft. She must have had nerves of steel, don't you think?
I think so, although it sounds like she was pretty skilled. So perhaps to her, this was, you know, part of her everyday course.
Have you come across criminals in your career as a barrister where you thought, my goodness, I don't know how you did that. It involves such nerve, such dexterity.
Absolutely. There's been clients that I've had that they are literally caught red-handed on CCTV and you're watching them back thinking, how fast did you do that? So, yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next thing that happens, according to the Chelmsford Chronicle newspaper, is that Fanny gets betrayed. And what's worse, by a female friend.
The next day, she paid a visit to a female acquaintance in His Majesty's jail of Newgate, gave her a guinea and a pair of silver buckles, and boasted of the exploit. This woman, being a favourite of the executioner, she communicated the matter to him, and Miss Davies was, the next day, apprehended in the borough with something more than £900 on her.
Fanny gets caught 3 days after the robbery in her lodgings in the borough, a disreputable part of South London.
She was soon after carried to the public office in Bow Street, where the notes were sworn to by Mr. Wigglesworth and her person ascertained by the chambermaid of the inn. Her boy's apparel was also produced. She denied any knowledge of the transaction with great composure.
Cool as a cucumber. Fanny gets taken to the jail at Chelmsford, back in Essex, to await trial. And on the way there, she passes the sign of the Three Rabbits, the scene of her crime. Now, Alexandra, Fanny is caught bang to rights. She's still got £900 concealed in her clothes when she's arrested, and eyewitnesses recognise her. If you were her barrister, how would you defend her in that situation?
I have been in these situations where they've been accused of a crime like theft or robbery, and they've been found with the items, and your client will sit there and look you in the eyes and say, it wasn't me. But ultimately, we take our clients' instructions, and so we will have to then advance a defence and we'll talk to them about a defence. But I would always, in that situation, advise them of the credit they would receive for pleading guilty and that would ultimately reduce any sentence that they'd later receive. And I think in this case particularly, that's where I would be starting.
Now, I wanted to know more about Fanny Davies' backstory. So I went to the borough, just south of London Bridge, to meet our resident historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. Roz and I are in the courtyard of the George. That's a coaching inn. Cheers, Roz.
Oh, cheers, Lucy.
It's in the borough where Fanny was born. I'm pretty sure that she knew this inn. And it was in the borough that she was apprehended after the robbery at the sign of the Three Rabbits. This part of town was home for her. Today, the borough is a very trendy part of town, but I wonder what it would have been like, Roz, round here in the late 18th century.
Well, Lucy, Borough High Street was one of the oldest roads in London, and it was this major route in and out of the capital. And so there were a number of coaching inns, just like the George, dotted along this street. And of course, at the northern end, Borough Market, the major fruit and veg market for London. So it was a really bustling, busy place. But in the 18th century, Borough and Southwark already had a reputation for being quite disreputable and even quite dangerous. And as well as all the coaching inns and taverns, there were also brothels. She learns how to pick pockets and also other forms of petty theft in pubs like the George, right? And I think she learns from places like this that travellers make good targets.
Do you think that Fanny actually picked a pocket in this courtyard?
I think it's highly likely, Lucy, yeah. Yeah, and we know that she dabbled in prostitution down in Tooley Street, and also she hangs out in the Mint, which was a particularly notorious neighbourhood of closely packed, dilapidated buildings and poor dwellings, and also thieves' kitchens where thieves would get together and hang out and plot.
Now, I've got here this most marvellous pamphlet, which was published at the time of Fanny's trial. It is called An Authentic Narrative of the Most Remarkable Adventures and Curious Intrigues Exhibited in the Life of Miss Fanny Davies, the Celebrated Modern Amazon. It's 54 pages long, and I love this picture here. We've got Fanny in her lady's dress, and then we've got Miss Fanny Davies in disguise. She's dressed as a man here. And it tells the story of her life, well, a story of her life, as luridly as possible. She picks up a young nobleman. She moves into his country house as his mistress. Then she fleeces him. She springs her actual boyfriend out of jail. She does more sex work. She robs both male and female clients. She picks pockets. She seduces people. And then, this is the most notorious bit, she becomes a highway person dressed as a man. So we've got crime, we've got class transgression, we've got loads of sex, we've got gender swapping, and all of this before she's 20 years old. It basically reads like a novel, doesn't it, Ros?
Yeah, no, it certainly does. It's quite a tale. But this is really a typical example of the true crime genre of the late 18th century. Cheap pamphlets on notorious and also sometimes fairly ordinary criminals. And the authors of these pamphlets really took significant liberties with the truth in order to appeal to readers. The author is definitely projecting all sorts of male fantasies onto Fanny. And to be honest, the public, they weren't really bothered whether this was true or not. But on another level, it's also a cautionary tale. Like many of the highwayman narratives of the time, it's about the danger of travelling. But also, specifically here, it's about the possibility of female con artists or swindlers.
Well, there's an awful lot in the pamphlet that reminds you of Moll Flanders, an 18th century novel about an enterprising criminal who lives off her wits, or even, you know, the story Fanny Hill, which is an erotic novel about a sex worker. Ros, do you see some overlap between the pamphlet and these kinds of works of fiction?
Yeah, raunchy Fanny Hill. I do, actually, because prostitution features really heavily in this account. But ultimately, there's likely to be some truth in here, right? Fanny Davies probably did resort to prostitution on occasion to make ends meet, just as she resorted to petty theft.
It's the pamphlet's central image of the highwaywoman, I think, Fanny on the horse with the pistol holding up a coach, that really captures our imagination. Do you think, Ros, that Fanny ever really did a hold-up of this nature?
It's possible that she was a highwaywoman, but it's also possible there's a lot of fiction mixed in. The author is drawing on a popular stereotype that's emerging of the kind of highwayman stand and deliver style. Because ultimately, we need to take all of these accounts with a pinch of salt, or perhaps a handful of salt, right? It could be argued that the story of Fanny's life is itself a swindle. It's so obviously embellished. And it's really hard here to separate the fact from the fiction.
Alexandra Wilson, in Fanny's case then, there's this highly fictionalised story of her life going about, circulated in pamphlets sold on street corners. And today, in your world, people make up stories about their lives all the time, don't they, on social media. How do you deal with that kind of issue when you're in court?
I think the most problematic time that we have to deal with stories circulating on social media, sometimes even in tabloids, is when we've got a jury trial, because juries can and often, in my view, are influenced by what's going on in the outside world. Judges will make very clear to jurors that they are not to be influenced. They're not to read about the case. They're not to Google the case. They're not to look on any social media site about the people involved in the case while the case is ongoing and while they have a decision to make. But particularly in high-profile cases, I would argue that that's almost impossible.
Fanny's trial is held back in Essex at Chelmsford Assizes on the 6th of March, 1786. It's one of several cases heard that day, and it's over incredibly quickly. She is found guilty, and the judge warns her.
You cannot anticipate a pardon or expect that your sex will protect you from the hand of justice.
And he passes the death sentence. Alex, the scale of the theft and Fanny's previous offences obviously count against her, but it's still shocking, isn't it, to us that she's sentenced to death for stealing? Now, according to the Bank of England's inflation calculator, the money she stole would be worth £160,000 today. What kind of sentence would you expect someone to get for a crime of that nature?
There are sentencing guidelines for theft offences, and the most serious are those that fall above £100,000. So the range is somewhere between 6 months and 6 years for a crime like that.
So if Fanny were in court today, 6 years in prison tops. Gosh.
I would think so. Yeah, I wouldn't expect her to receive any more than that. There are things that can aggravate a sentence. So, for example, if a vulnerable person is taken advantage of, but it doesn't sound as though she was intentionally targeting people who were particularly vulnerable. It sounds like Fanny was going out, meeting some men and taking their money.
I've got a feeling that Mr. Wigglesworth could afford to buy himself a new pair of trousers after she nicked them.
Right.
Now, after Fanny's trial, publishers get busy once again, producing souvenir pamphlets to be sold at her execution. We're looking at one now. It includes a crude but really gruesome woodcut of Fanny, and she's on the scaffold. She's being hanged. Poor Fanny. Alex, what do you think when you look at that one?
It's actually a really difficult image to look at. I'm sure it's no surprise to hear, very opposed to the death penalty. I think it's so difficult to look at this image because, particularly back in Fanny's day, I would have questions about the strength of the evidence. I know we talked about her being caught kind of red-handed with this money in her pocket, but we don't have any way of, you know, proving that she committed this crime or anyone else committed this crime in the way that we understand crimes to be proved today. You know, I think the standard back then would be very different to what we now see. And I think even now there are some injustices. And to think that someone's life was taken, there's no going back from that.
Now, Alex, listen to what happened when I met up with Ros Crone to hear the end of Fanny's story. Now, Ros, I thought we'd be meeting today at Chelmsford Jail for you to tell me about Fanny's execution. But no, we're not. We are several miles away from Chelmsford at Tilbury, and we're standing overlooking the very wide and very windy River Thames.
Yeah, Lucy, we're not at Chelmsford Jail because Fanny wasn't executed. In fact, her sensational crime and trial, they're just the beginning of an even more extraordinary life, because Fanny's death sentence was commuted to 14 years transportation.
Wow. So does that mean she was sent to Australia?
She was, yeah. Fanny was part of the very first group of convicts sent to Australia, what we now know as the First Fleet. And she boarded the ship that took her to Australia right over there at Gravesend.
Oh, my goodness. And why did the judge let her off being hanged then? Why was the sentence commuted to transportation instead?
Good question, Lucy. Yeah, it's not entirely clear. However, it's important to note the judge doesn't get to decide. In this period, it's up to the king and his cabinet who gets a pardon and who gets a conditional pardon or a commuted sentence. But the judge does get to make recommendations, and despite his summing up where he was very certain that Fanny was going to die, in this case, he does seem to have recommended mercy.
What do we know about Fanny's voyage to Australia then?
Well, the entire fleet that was heading to Australia in 1787 had 582 convict men and 193 convict women, as well as the crews for the ship and also the marines, the soldiers who would be watching over them when they got to the colony. We know some details about the voyage from the journal of the ship's surgeon on board, the Lady Penryn. He was called Arthur Bowes, and he included a list of all the female convicts on board. And I've brought you a copy of that list, Lucy. And can you see at the top, Frances Davies?
Davies, there she is. She's 22 years old, and her trade is service, and her crime is robbery, for which she has a term of 14 years in Australia. And was it horrible conditions on the boat?
Yeah, it took about 8 months to reach Australia. And for most of that time, the women were confined below decks, and you can imagine it was densely packed. There were 101 women on board the Lady Penryn. Also, they had some of their children. Some of the women and children died on the voyage, and the discipline could be quite brutal as well. In the early days of the voyage, the women were flogged. Later, they were put in irons or had their heads shaved. The women also formed relationships with the men, members of the crew and also the Marines. They realized that if they used the promise of sex, that they could extract favors or items that they wanted, luxuries like tea or nice clothes.
And what was it like for Fanny and the others when they actually got to Australia?
I think it's difficult for us today to really appreciate or to imagine what it must have been like landing at Sydney Cove in the early days of 1788. It's still a wilderness. It had an existing population as well. They had to build shelter, they had to grow food, and they had to establish a functioning society. In the early days, there were problems maintaining discipline, and violence was used to try to impose order. It proved immensely difficult to grow food using the seeds they had brought out from England. They were also in conflict at times with the indigenous population, and we've got to recognise this was an invasion. And as for the women, they faced particular challenges. Those who had formed relationships on the way out, some of those men went back to England, leaving the women alone with small children. Some women even banded together and they set up a brothel in those early days in the colony, recognising that there was a desire for that kind of service. But most of the women were thrown into domestic drudgery. They had to do the washing and the cooking for the entire colony. So it was a hard life, but it was a hard life with some optimism and, over time, opportunities to prosper. I think that women recognised this and they could see that they had a potential here to create a different and perhaps a better life.
So it's an entirely new life and world.
Completely different from anything she would have experienced in England.
Alex, what do you make of that then? That's quite a twist in the tale.
Absolutely. At first, I was smiling. I really was so pleased to hear, okay, well, Fanny's not being subjected to the death penalty. I was really pleased. And then it was a bit of a roller coaster. But yeah, what a twist in the tale.
Voz Crone has now joined us in the studio.
Hello, Lucy, and hello, Alex.
Voz, can you tell us what happens to Fanny after she's arrived in Australia?
Yes, Lucy, I can. Historians have been very interested in the first fleeters. So we know, for example, that Fanny adopted a baby after the baby's mother died. Apparently, between 1801 and 1828, she returned to England three times, but always came back to Australia. And that's rather extraordinary, actually, to go back so many times. And we have no idea how she was able to afford that. In 1811, we know that she married a man called Martin Mintz, a German, and they opened a bakery together in Clarence Street in Sydney. But unfortunately, the bakery didn't go so well, and it looks like Martin committed suicide in 1813. One of the last records we have of Fanny comes from the muster records of 1825, where she's working as a housekeeper, and she would have been in her early 60s by that point.
Do we know when she actually died in the end?
Yeah, soon after that, in November 1828, when she was aged about 64. And she was buried in the Devonshire Street Cemetery, which is now the site, actually, of Sydney's Central Station. So the cemetery's been lost. But Fanny is listed on one of the First Fleet memorials in Sydney.
What do you take away from her life story, Roz?
Well, it's hard not to get swept up in it and to see Fanny as some kind of extraordinary woman. She was born in a slum. She had an affair with a nobleman. She hung out with a criminal gang. She committed this amazing, audacious theft while pretending to be a man and stole what was a small fortune. And she was one of the first convicts sent to Australia. You couldn't make it up, could you?
We root for her, don't we? We're on Fanny's side.
But actually, some of it likely was made up. it's too good to be true. We have a really challenging set of sources which underline this story, including this entertaining biography that was written for audiences to entertain them, to reflect contemporary perceptions of crime and gender. And remember that we haven't heard from Fanny at all. Her voice isn't captured in any of those sources. And in the end, when we read between the lines of what we've got, we find what I think is a more interesting or significant story, which is about survival
and it's about the resourcefulness and creativity of women who were born in a similar situation to Fanny in poverty and hardship. And I think Fanny would have shared this kind of survival instinct and creativity with her companions on the First Fleet. And they worked really hard to make the best of their situation and to find opportunities. And I really think that focusing on this, rather than Fanny's extraordinariness, if you like, is what I call doing women's history.
Absolutely, Ross. I could not agree more. Alex, I wonder how you'd feel about Fanny if she were your client.
Hearing about Fanny's life, I have this image in my head of her being one of those clients, that someone that I would sit down with and have a bit of a laugh with, despite all of the kind of trials and tribulations of what was going on in her personal life. And so I think I would have quite liked Fanny as a client.
What do you take away from her life story?
The biggest takeaway for me is just how young she was when she was caught up in the criminal justice system. We have to bear in mind that when she went to Australia, she was just 22. She was so young. And so I think for me, despite the kind of, you know, the bad crimes that she committed, that she's still an impressive woman.
Hmm. I think we're all signed up Fanny fans, aren't we?
Absolutely.
I doubt whether many of the stories about Fanny Davies' early life were actually true, but she was clearly a resilient and resourceful young woman. She was so amazingly bold. She took such incredible risks. And being born into poverty in the 18th century, she had to survive on her looks and her wits. Like many women in the criminal justice system even today, it was probably her poverty rather than a desire for adventure that drew her into her life of theft and sex work. I guess Fanny's story reminds me that it's all too easy to glamorise women who commit crimes. And we project our fantasies onto them, don't we? But I do find her story inspiring. She built this whole new life for herself in Australia, and she must have sailed further than almost any other woman at the time. Certainly after escaping from the gallows in her early 20s, she had a life packed with more adventure than most novelists or writers of salacious pamphlets could possibly have imagined. Well, a huge thank you to Alexandra Wilson and our historical consultant, Professor Rosalind Crone. Next time, we are at the Royal Academy in London with Aunt Mary Provis, an art hoaxer who had the greatest painters in the land eating out of her hand. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. And you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.